When I first heard that Dicey's song had been awarded the Newbery Medal, which was, by the way, several minutes after Peggy Coughlin had actually told me the news, several minutes and a couple of glasses of champagne, I entered into a state of massive incoherence. I have not yet completely emerged from that state, and suspect now I may never. But one of my first sensible thoughts during the time was, I did not know good news could pack such a wallop. I didn't know good news could keep you awake into the night, distract you so effectively from all appointed tasks, make it difficult, when you confronted it head-on, to breathe properly. One of my second thoughts was, I guess it's time to learn how to spell Newbery. For years, on reading lists and curriculum suggestions, in letters recommending books to friends, I have misspelled it, known I was misspelling it, and never remembered what the particular error was that I tended to make. I know how to spell it now. N-E-W-B-E-R-Y. Savoring every letter, and I thank you. Privately, for my confidence in myself as a strong speller. Publicly, for the honor. But primarily, as a writer. First, quite humbly, for the high compliment. And then with a sense of rejoicing, because you have given to the Tillermans, people of whom I am terrifically fond, a chance for the kind of immortality only characters in books can possess. The pleasures of the Newbery Medal are many, are various and deep, are all intensely satisfying. The terrors of the Newbery Medal are, I find, while not so numerous, and in a perverse way, equally satisfying, very real. Large among them has loomed the very occasion which finds us here this evening. Natural vanity aside, whatever is there for me to say to you? Thank you, of course, and I would be quite happy to repeat those words for several minutes. But I was given to understand that if I could think of something else, something perhaps more substantial, that would be preferable. Obediently, I examined the possibilities. I thought of simply telling the string of anecdotes which I label Newbery stories, as a show and tell of the pleasure you have given. I thought of conducting an analytical review of past Newbery books, by way of ostensive definition that I know what an honor it is. Since it is the book, not the author, which receives the award, although the author bears the brunt of it, I considered reading aloud to you my favorite passages from Dicey's song. I even thought that this might be the occasion for my famous fallback position. Should all else fail, I've always thought I could deliver a brilliant lecture on Sonnet 78, Farewell, Thou Art Too Dear for My Possessing. In short, I boggled. A friend suggested I was having difficulty assuming the role of cultural spokeswoman. I agreed, which got me no further, but clarified much. I at least understood that this was yet another of the ambiguities of being a writer. Perhaps these are not really ambiguities, but merely oddities. The most basic oddity is that curious time lag between the writer and the reading. When I signed the contract for my first book, I looked at the time schedule with some surprise, realizing that in those same months I could produce two babies. Later, the time lag established itself into the position of being held responsible, for good or ill, for a work you had finished long ago, which was not the work you were presently wrestling down, not what you were presently fully engrossed by, not what you presently referred to when you spoke of my writing. The second oddity has to do with the question of one's appropriate attitude towards one's own work. I have discovered that I do not want to be the best critical reader of my own books. I do not even think I should aspire to that, any more than I should aspire to holding the most accurate, objective attitude towards my own children. When I submitted Dicey's song to my editor, it was with the firm conviction that they would probably not want to publish it. My cover letter read something like, I don't know that you will want this, but I think you will love reading it. The third oddity is the most interesting, most engaging. This one crops up when people, readers, editors, friends, reviewers, tell me about my work, because often I am enlightened by what I hear. The first time this happened, I was asked quite casually about homecoming, isn't that every mother's dream? Just to walk away from it all? Well, I thought to myself, recognizing the validity of the observation. And then, thinking on, I understood how reassuring the story was to me as a parent. Since that time, I have understood more clearly that while a book may be out, that doesn't mean necessarily that I am finished with it, or it is finished with me. And perhaps that is why I have never had the impulse to type the end at the conclusion of a story. Moreover, I have begun to see that when you write a book, you are in the rare position of being responded to on a level which, for most of us, most of the time, goes unremarked. One bases one's life on certain essential ideas about the nature and purpose of the entire endeavor and the participants thereof. But seldom do these essential ideas, which in fact govern choices and actions, receive direct attention. Seldom, in the course of daily living, do people have the opportunity or inclination to tell us about ourselves, how they see us, what they think of what we do. It is this third oddity which has led me to my topic. I would like, if I may, to tell you how I see you, what I think of what you do. In the back of my mind, my remarks tonight are entitled The Argument for Excellence and Appreciation. In the field of children's literature, it seems to me the word excellence can be applied with unusual frequency. I will not repeat it often, lest I sound too much like one of my own characters, but I would like to start out with a couple of interesting points about the word, as defined in the OED. Its Latin root, excellere, means to rise above others, and itself comes from the word cellere, to rise high, to tower, which, and I like the implications of this, occurs only in compound forms. The first definition of the English root excel is, quote, to be superior or preeminent in the possession of some quality or in the performance of some action, usually in good sense, end quote. The idea that good sense is closely associated with preeminence is a necessary attribute of superiority, rings in even more implications. It removes from excellence the stigma of otherworldliness, or ivory towerhood, and places the word squarely where it belongs, in the realm of the possible and desirable. In thinking over this subject, I have broken children's literature down into three large areas. First, the end results, the things themselves, books. Second, the enablers, publishing houses and their editorial staffs. And third, those which make available, libraries and librarians. These three aspects exist in some symbiotic relationship to create what I call the field of children's literature. First, the books. Any field that can regularly produce 4 or 5 stunning books a year has to have an eye on excellence. A stunning book engages the imagination, sets to work the intelligence, fills the spirit. The reliability with which such books appear in children's literature is wonderful, satisfying, and too marked to be accidental. The works that appear in children's literature bear easily the analytical approach. In a classroom, I teach that the elements of fiction are plot, character, and theme, with the unspoken understanding that a writer's style will be good. In plot, children's books are characterized by boldness and ambition, by unhedged bets. Without apology or excuse, 4 children walk through the back of a wardrobe into a magical land. A boy is shanghaied into service on a slave ship, and the grim experience marks his entire life, as it must. A wind-up mouse and his wind-up son make a journey through servitude, the arts, philosophy, war and peace, love, despair, and spiritual rebirth. All this in a world observed by a powerful being who occasionally utters not entirely coherent phrases of challenge and benediction. A good story declares its own terms. Excellent books are those which work within those terms without compromise. The range of characters in children's literature is not so remarkable as is the consistent validity. A thoroughly unexceptional pig grown to understanding of how to value what he has and what he has lost, able to recognize that a good friend who is also a good writer is a rare spider. A homosexual teacher whose face has been horribly burned, who still suffers, still honors the justice of it, still can give love. A child spy who scouts the streets of New York, her originality more clear to the reader than to herself. A clear-headed doll whose 100 years of existence broaden her mind without dissipating her sense of values. In excellent books, plot and character exist in appropriate symmetry under idea, or they emerge out of idea in a synthesis that can lead the reader who is ready back to the governing idea. Those minipins who win the Gamage Cup have earned it by reaching beyond themselves. They value their achievement and the changes it has brought. Moreover, they recognize that they may never again reach so far, and further, that they will, in need, be able to do so again. The idea leads on and out, backwards and forwards through the book, informing plot and illuminating character. The quality of having been thought through is characteristic of children's literature. Effectively, what this excellence means is a range of books I can recommend with confidence to a variety of readers, as well as several books which, year after year, I can take into the classroom, and they do not fail to engage the students, and they do not fail to evoke from me my own best work, year after year. In a lecture given at St. John's College, Joe Sachs speaks of the purposes of reading, declining to accept the categories of amusement and instruction as exhaustive. He says, quote, "Stories that affect us set our imaginations to work. That activity can disclose ourselves to us, what we care about, what we fear, what we long for. The combination of disclosure and stimulation may, as it does with Don Quixote, inspire action. Even when it doesn't, it may enrich the interior realm from which thought and action can be nourished." End quote. He speaks, of course, of fiction at its best. I add only that children's literature tends, with exhilarating frequency, to be at its best. These children's books do not appear upon the shelves ex nihilo. They are brought forth by the publishers and editors whose governance enables excellence. Publishers are structural enablers. They establish and maintain the business which produces the books. They work with the hard edges of necessity. When my first book appeared, it was at 2/3 of its original volume, and even so it set new horizons of price. The publisher both required and permitted this, made and enacted the decision. He worked his work, which enables me to work mine. And editors. I have a long rhapsodic speech about editors in me, to which I will not subject you. The editor works upon, works over, the manuscript, to enable it to be the best it can. An editor must be, more than anything else, dexterous, able to cover the territory between the publisher and the writer, as well as the territory between the writer and the reader. An editor must be able to sit in all three of those chairs, without losing her grip on her own sense of what is good in literature. An editor deals critically with the writer, and in so doing, sees both the overall effect of the work and the functioning of each contributing part. The editor sees not only the work accomplished, but also the work to come, which means seeing more of the writer than the writer does. The job involves appreciating what is and eliciting what might be. This has become clear to me in hindsight, which is itself appropriate. It is not a sign of being managed well if you notice at the time that you are being well managed. During our shaking down period, when my editor was writing me letters that instructed me to do some severe cutting back, and I was answering with letters that began, "I have no theory of art, but," I suspect she knew that it was just that, a shaking down period. I suspect that she knew we would, one way or another, move past it. I suspect further that she hoped, as much as I would have done had I known just what was going on, that we would move beyond it well. I feel myself extremely fortunate in my editor. More significant, I know that my experience is not unique. Other writers in the field feel and speak just so of their editors. There is dexterity implied in this. The same dexterity is clear before you if you look at the variety and quality of books that have come out from under the hands of editors, even so narrow a list as that of this year's Newbery Honor Books. One, an adventure fantasy built around a full-blooded character, which it is perhaps needless to point out is Tolkien's essential strength. One, a picture storybook marked in illustration and diction by delicate wit. One, an autobiography that makes real and comprehensible a foreign land and people, as well as, not incidentally, underlining the sense for one's own land and people. One, a modern ghost story written in the kind of virile and poetic style any writer must envy, a ghost story that points out the possibility of breaking the restrictive patterns of the past. One, three short tales, each wrought with a sense of irony. The list has great variety and consistent quality. The books themselves argue the kind of editorial work that has gone into them and give evidence to its excellence. Once out in print, these children's books become the concern of libraries and librarians. Libraries house, safeguard, give place to. Librarians are stewards who care for, supply, and maintain. In my mind's eye, the words library and librarian evoke three images. First is the library at Alexandria, built by kings of Egypt upon Aristotle's personal library. The collection contained many thousands of papyrus manuscripts. Several thousand scribes and scholars worked and studied there. There Euclid wrote the Elements. There the water clock was invented. I see it as sun-drenched buildings, its halls worn gently by the passage of sandaled feet. The second image is that of the monasteries, where monks copied and illustrated manuscripts, making them beautiful and preserving what would otherwise have been irretrievably lost. The third is more personal, a memory of a library in Connecticut, a building with thick stone walls, where dust motes moved through the light, rooms filled with the kind of silence peculiar to temples of all religions, as if the air itself were enriched with the ideas contained therein. Granted, these images are some ideal vision. Granted the overwhelmingly mundane quality of daily life, still the ideal informs the real, shapes and guides it, justifies it in both the concrete and abstract meanings of that word. So I allow myself the image of what a library essentially is. What a library actually is, what librarians actually do, may be less idealized, but is no less designed for excellence. They make available the books, display them, put them into the hands of readers. They maintain the dialogue with the community they serve. This dialogue involves not only knowing what books there are and where to find them, but also knowing how to recommend to individual readers those books that will suit. Like teachers, librarians gauge ability, maturity, interest. They note not only present achievement, but probable direction of growth. Librarians go into schools to do storytelling, give book talks, perform puppet shows. They encourage responses and give room to them. Any free wall space of the Children's Library in Annapolis is covered with drawings and comments from its readers. In Prince George's County, a panel of children has for years published Crabs, a small magazine of reviews and recommendations under the aegis of the library system with the guidance of the librarian. Libraries and librarians make available books covering a broad range, picture books, science fiction novels, books of poetry and history, cookbooks, books on dinosaurs, books on drugs. The complete list exceeds Polonian aptitudes. They make available also movies, tapes and records, pictures and music, stories and song. They not only make available, but also give space and forms to responses, so that libraries can be seen, and rightly, as cultural storehouses. Moreover, so viewed, the ideal is not that distant from the real. The architecture changes, and the habit, but the purpose remains. Finally, the field of children's literature is controlled by two factors which operate in its favor, making it somehow more possible to achieve excellence. The first of these is money. It is all right to talk about money. In Moby Dick, Melville recognizes and addresses the question of commerce. In an emblematic, mystical work, which may be about the confrontation of good and evil, or may be about the unity that binds polarities into place, commerce has its role. Commercially speaking, it can be said that children's literature is not a greedy industry. To this, everyone, writers, publishers, editors, library systems, and librarians, can attest. The commercial modesty of children's literature, I suspect, enables the field to continue its steady emphasis on quality. So that, far from being a dismal fact, it is a situation of which the soul approves and common sense argues the wisdom. An adequate, but not seductive, financial base ensures that the main motive of all concerned in the field can be the overall quality of the field. In other words, the limit works for excellence. The second controlling factor is the audience, children. I recognize without being able to define it that the audience of children's literature does establish limits. Most vivid is the most extreme example, the notion of writing books for those who cannot read. This model can be expanded along a chronological and emotional path to express the controls the audience places upon the field. The model expresses also the unique nature of those controls. It is in the nature of children to be creatures in process. Perhaps because they are so aware of that, it is in the nature of children also to know what we have foolishly forgotten or improperly subordinated, that the possible is a viable and functioning part of the real. This insight of theirs marks the field of children's literature, encouraging excellence. To answer my own questions, then, how do I see you? I see you as I see myself, a part of something in which we can all take pride. What do I think of what you do? I think it is important. I think you work hard and well. I think you are, as I am, lucky to be involved in children's literature. As you probably realize by now, I have been craftily following my first plan for these remarks, to say thank you. As reader and teacher, I thank you for the excellence. As writer, I want to say thank you again to the Newbery Committee, to the ALA and its members. I want also to say thank you to publishers in general, to Athenaeum in particular, and to Gail Paris most particularly. And lastly, I would like to acknowledge some private debts of gratitude. To my parents, who taught me about family love and gave me the space to make mistakes. To my husband, for, among many other things, both his good readings and his good influence. To Jessica, who from the first draft of the first chapter has followed the Tillermans and asked to hear more about them. And to Duffel, too. What can a 5-year-old imp of unreason contribute? Oddly enough, what nobody else so consistently can. I will give you an example from life. 48 hours after the famous phone call, during which hours the house had been reverberating with the words Newbery and Los Angeles, we went out for a family celebration dinner. Duffel leaned forward to announce to his grandmother the big news. We are going to Chicago because Mommy won the Blueberry Award. So to Duffel, who keeps my feet on the ground, and to the rest of you who have put my head in the clouds, thank you very much.